Oh, yeah. That's composer and trombonist J.J. Johnson and a quartet of stellar jazz musicians with Bag's Groove, a Miles Davis tribute to vibraphonist Milt Jackson. Bag's was his nickname. This was recorded on August 29th, 1958, and features Nat Adderley on cornet, Tommy Flanagan on piano, Wilbur Little on bass, and Albert Heath, one of the famous Heath brothers, on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and it is Judgment Day. It is a Super Tuesday, the third Super Tuesday in this election cycle, and Democratic and Republican presidential candidates are in make-or-break mode today, tangling with each other in primaries in Florida, Ohio, Illinois, Missouri, and North Carolina. And a very interesting thing, too, they'll be competing with each other in one of two commonwealths. Yes, the U.S. is an empire, after all. The Northern Mariana Islands, also known as the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands. I'm sure you didn't know we had that as part of the United States Empire. But the Northern Mariana Islands and Puerto Rico have the dubious distinction of being these commonwealths attached to the United States. But today, a lot of jostling going on because it will make or break some of the candidates. We expect by the end of the day that on the Republican side, we will see a whittling away, chipping away at the number of candidates. We don't expect all four to continue. Somebody's going to make a decision that if they don't do well, they might as well check out now. And on the Democratic side, we will see by the end of the day who will have the locked lead on being that party's nominee in the general election. So it's a pretty exciting day for those people who are into elections from this perspective, but all the more significant coming behind the most recent developments and the trouble on the Republican side with Donald Trump. It has bled over to the general election, the election as a whole, I should say, because everybody's now concerned suddenly about the tenor and tone of Donald Trump's campaign. That skirmish in Chicago bringing to light a seedy side of U.S. politics and a sense of self-denial, actually, denial of reality. Political violence is nothing new to U.S. politics at all. We've seen that happen many, many times in the course of the political season. But it is interesting that it is being noted now, because I don't know whether it's especially embarrassing, especially galling, or whether something else is happening here. I had contended early on when the election just started to crank up that we have to regard this election as a kind of watershed moment in American history. I know it doesn't look like it. It doesn't feel historic, but it actually is historic. Not because, you know, there's one of the front runners, supposed front runners, Hillary Clinton, may just be the first woman president. That's not the reason. It is going to be historic because we will see, perhaps years from now, that at this time, the United States, it's realigning itself. It's the system is adjusting itself. It is going through a necessary metamorphosis. having to do with the maintenance of the white supremacist order. It has changed and it will continue to change, and it is an inevitable change because of the demographic shift that is about to occur. And that will, for years and years and years to come, permanently change the culture of the United States. By 2032, as I've discussed, the United States will become a majority non-white nation. It already has made that direction in at least 11 states. And one can expect that it will pick up, given the birth rates of non-white populations and the death rates of white populations. So there's a whole realignment going on, even as we speak. That is the real context for this election. All the stuff that we are hearing with the buzzwords of violence and anger, the American people, which means white America, that's how it's done. that's the code word. The American people are angry, we're told. And for a reason, because the goodies that come with privileges and the rights that come with being a member of the privileged class in this country, these things are under direct assault from their perspective. And it doesn't matter so much the class distinction. It is important that they recognize the racial distinction. And that is really what they're reacting to. The so-called middle-class America that we are hearing about in terms of the candidates promising jobs and, making America great again and whatnot, all of these things are responses to the evidence that is all around us that there's growing concern about losing ground. The powerful, the people who long have enjoyed privileges and rights and the benefits of white supremacy, are beginning to understand that they will be outnumbered, and therefore all of the trappings of power, in their view, will be under assault, and they will, by necessity, have to be shared. And you don't have shared power. This is not a concept that works in the United States. It never has. No shared power. You either belong to the group that is in control or you belong to the group that is controlled. So this is where we are in this historic moment where the society has to make these adjustments in order to set the stage for the inevitable, that being that huge, cataclysmic, seismic demographic shift that is right around the corner. And in this battle to maintain white supremacy, there is a very great attempt to congeal whatever is seen as the white world in the United States. They have to bring it all together. That call that we've been hearing lately about the need for unity, what they mean is we should all come together because we have a shared interest in balkanizing this society once again. Things had become a bit too loose, and things are getting even worse in that regard. We have too much intermarriage. We have too much movement, uncontrolled movement, unregulated movement. And we've got to return to a re-stratification of American society. This is how it was, the founding fathers. This is what their vision was. This is what their intent was. to set it so that it does not change. Well, change has occurred for all kinds of reasons. We have more whites dying than are being born to replace them. We have a loosening of the definition of whiteness in America. People who are now considered white or quasi-white didn't have a chance. And that includes a whole bunch of them running today. You know, many of the, if not most of the candidates running. And right now, practically all of the candidates running have that in common. They were recently admitted, and conditionally so for some of them, like Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, and Bernie Sanders, and Hillary Clinton, and John Kasich. None of these people would have been considered white a couple of decades ago. But because supremacy requires a numerical advantage, from time to time it relaxes the rules in order to beef up the numbers. This happens, you look through U.S. history, and in particular, you pay attention to what a group called race theorists, critical race theorists. These are lawyers, legal scholars, really, who look at our society through legal decisions as it pertains to race. And we see from the work of Theodore Allen, which we have discussed here, the invention of the white race. He pinpoints precisely the moment in U.S. history where this concept of whiteness was born. The word white was just not part of the vocabulary until the late 1600s with the arrival of Europeans. This false construct of race then began. I recommend that book highly. I recommend Ian Haney Lopez's book, White by Law, in which he traces U.S. Supreme Court decisions having to do strictly with this notion of racial classification. Who is white and who is not white? At one point, Arabs were white. And then they said, we don't think so. We changed that rule. Anyone at one point with a Spanish surname was white. Hence, Ted Cruz would have been considered white as it applies in the United States. And Marco Rubio would have been white. But then they saw Dominicans. And they said, time to change that. So they changed that. At one point, Asians were white. And then they changed that rule. So we have all kinds of definitions of this term white depending on the socio-political and cultural need at the time to maintain white supremacy. So people were given provisional membership in the circles of whiteness, pretty much like in South Africa, where depending on your classification in terms of your economic the bucks you have in the bank, you could be an honorary white. Many African Americans traveling to South Africa during apartheid were given honorary white status. Even though whites, of course, were an extreme minority in the country, they were in control of the country. And people maintain that exists even to this day. So the same thing is happening here in the United States. We have a reorganization of our society because it is necessary. White people, as defined by the power elite, are dying out. Their numbers are dwindling. They need to be beefed up. Some people will become white. And in this race, as you've seen, even people like Ben Carson. They made Ben Carson a white guy. Ben Carson made himself white. he so understood this rule. He's not waiting to be. He's not waiting for the invitation. He just decided, look, I qualify. I'm not one of those people. I'm different. So this is what is happening. I'm kidding, but I'm not. You know, you understand. The idea is that this is the moment we're in. A Donald Trump never would have had a prayer. Drumpf, his family's name, it would never have been a passport to whiteness in America. And that is why he is extremely white in terms of his philosophical and ideological, if I dare even ascribe these things to him, if he's capable of having a philosophy or an ideology. But he's extreme in his expression of it in order to indicate he is a white person as we understand the political term to be. So don't miss this moment and don't miss the significance of this. This is really what is happening. So what happens when you are overrun by non-whites? You relax the rules, you beef up your numbers, and then you strictly control all of the privileges and the rights and the assets. That's what you do. And the mechanisms of control. You beef that up to the extreme. Because you're still keeping in mind that the numbers of really, really, really white people are down. And you have relaxed the rules. You've given provisional membership. And you may just want to, you know, yank that back at one point or another. For example, in this fight with Donald Trump, you would notice how and why he's being attacked, severely being attacked. And he's being attacked not only because of who he is and the undercurrent, the unexpressed undercurrent there has to do with the reference to Adolf Hitler and his Germanic background. Don't miss that. This is white on white racism here. The other piece of that is that he represents a pool of whiteness that was considered very undesirable. The white people that Donald Trump, for the most part, appeals to are not desirable people at all. They are black white people. They are true minorities in the world of whiteness. They don't see these white people as being desirable as members in the world of whiteness. But if they have to take them, they will. If they have to take them and incorporate them into the world of, you know, to beef up the numbers, they'll do that. But they're not happy about it. And that is why Donald Trump doesn't care. He understands, billionaire that he is not a white man in America in the sense that the founding fathers meant it. He's a rich guy. And for all intents and purposes, as the loosening of the definition would have it, he is a white man. But he knows in his heart of hearts, this country was not really his. He can't lay claim to it by inference. He has to state it. He has to insist that he be recognized in the world of whiteness. The real white people with power in this country don't have to go around talking about how much power they have. They just quietly control things. He has to brag about it because at the end of it all, he is second tier. He's not old money. He's not of good, solid, white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant stock. culturally, he is at odds with how whiteness in this country defines itself. And the people, billionaire that he is, you would see who really looks to him for leadership. And those are just really, those are really not good people, not in the world of whiteness. They're not very, very desirable at all. And that accounts, in my view, this is my theory, for the ferocity of Donald Trump's assault on the political establishment. The undercurrent there is that he's saying, in so far as you think I don't belong, I don't have to respect any of your traditions. I don't have to respect any of your beliefs. I don't have to respect any of your ways. I make my own way. All the money he has, he's still considered crude. He's still considered, well, not yet fully baked. He's not done yet. He's not ready for the real world of whiteness in this country. Or in any other country, for that matter. Any other European country. He's not ready. He's not of that ilk. Now, other people have already done the surgery to themselves. They have cleaned up. They have deracinated themselves. They have cleansed themselves as much as possible of the things that people would find, the people of power would find objectionable. You can't constantly, you know, have us talk about your culture and your language and no good. We're trying not to recognize that, so why bring it up? So they do it themselves. They edit themselves to make themselves as white as possible. Barack Obama did that. Many of my friends thought I was going crazy when I said it. He had performed on himself that kind of surgery, the deracination. I will make myself as non-threatening and as close as possible to your liking, to your definition of what whiteness is. I'll do that. And we saw the consequences. He had to stick to the script, and he did it faithfully for 8 years. He still continues. Every now and then they give him a little room to, you know, a little bit of wiggle room, and he can do things on his own. But that accounts for the obstruction in Congress, because they said, hey, fellow, listen, we are the real power here. You don't get to do things, even though you ran for president and you won it fair and square and you are in the White House and you got your degree, you're a Harvard man, and you're young and you're vibrant and all of that stuff. The fact is, you do not belong where you think you belong. And we, people in the Senate, lowly Congress people, actually wield the power in this country over the president. The military, Barack Obama could call himself commander-in-chief if he wants. The same will go for Donald Trump. He could talk all this stuff about where he's going to bomb next and which war he's going to start next. The generals understand who wield the power. And they understand that he will soon understand what his limitations are. They will not take orders from him. You see? So all these things, all this bluster that is confusing things, we have to remember this is how our society operates. Donald Trump understands that implicitly. And that accounts in large measure for his crude and some would say just plain racist appeal, because in the end, the calculation is he has to appeal to a base. And it doesn't have to be, and he would rather it not be, a multicultural base. Because he's interested now in qualifying for whiteness. For practical purposes, he doesn't care who votes. He doesn't care whether how culturally diverse it is. In fact, it's a plus. But do you think that when Donald Trump sits down right now to run his corporation, and when he decides what he's going to do next or what he ought to do next, do you think that that room is a diverse room? You really think there's just everybody, there's kumbaya moment going on in his corporate offices? You really think that? No. He reverts to the basic definitions again. Non-whites, as he defines them, don't have the capacity to lead. Same with Hillary Clinton. They, even though, again, both she and Bill never, ever, especially coming out of Arkansas, from middle class, and I'm stretching here, in the case of Bill, absolutely working class or working poor families. In other words, people without pedigree never would have made it in the white world, and did not, as a matter of fact, make it in the white world until black people were convenient and were strategically used to launch them into political orbit. And they have remained there ever since on that one note. You vote for me, and I'll make you grateful that you voted for me. But in the world of whiteness, these folks, even to this day, they don't qualify. Now, a Nancy Reagan is a whole different thing. You see? So you have to understand the world of whiteness in this country, how it works, how it operates, and why. When you see these things happening, you have to read it and connect these dots. That flare-up in Chicago, this was not outside of the experience or the intent of Donald Trump and the people who follow him. They understand where they are in the world of whiteness. You see, they understand it. Black people just don't understand it. Latinos don't get it. Oppressed people are not connecting these things. But people understand it implicitly. The people who are in control and are accustomed to being in control and are of the mindset that they ought to be in control, they get that. And that is why in all of this, we are not discussing race. Instead, we will be discussing violence. You know, violence. All of a sudden, everybody's so, just aghast at this idea that the violence in the United States at this level, how unbecoming, how rare. Well, that means you haven't been reading. It means you're not in touch with your history. This is America. That's what it is. What you saw, that's a microcosm. That's just a tiny little window opening into that world. The world, the reality that we are living. That's reality. The news people are going to tell us that it was an aberration, and they continue to tell us this thing is an aberration, when we know that that's the standing reality. Because really, what fueled all of this? Was it, you know, violence? No. Violence was just the agency of it. What is at the root of all of this is the very thing I'm talking about. The long-standing social order white supremacy in this country. And everybody is shaped by it. Now that is the ultimate power, to have everybody calibrated against a false and indefensible construct. My notion of my identity is calibrated against somebody else's notion of what my identity is. My rights are measured as against the rights other people think I ought to have. And those rights, by necessity, from a white supremacist point of view, must be different, i.e., inferior. They not only must be different, they must be of no use to me. That's why, again, in that one moment, when that man, the white man, attacked the black man at a Donald Trump rally, it was like a tale being told in front of our eyes about all of these things wrapped up in one. In that one instant, we saw what America is all about. And Trump at that time saying, "I'll pay you legal fees. Don't worry about busting somebody's face. It's all right, at my urging. You have my permission." Because in this country, it's understood, some people have constitutional rights, protected rights, guaranteed rights. Others have none. You have our rights devolve from amendments to the Constitution, very, very reluctantly given, but all padded with loopholes that say, okay, you can have this right. You have the right to vote, all right? Well, that is supposed to represent the triumph of the people and the conscience of the government, a white supremacist system, basically summoning its moral courage to do the right thing and grant its citizens the universal aspect of democracy, the right to vote. But then, as we know, you get the so-called right to vote, and there are 455 ways to prevent you to prevent that right from actually having any force at all. And you got to go back to the courts to ask for a right that's supposed to be, what, indivisible. And equal justice and all that stuff. It just simply does not obtain in our society. And we keep missing the point. That's why I keep talking about it. The elections are another example. The current election. It is the standing order that elections are to be had. The duopoly, as they have for a long, long time, right, since, what, the 1700s? The duopoly has been taking care of its business in the same way it has, just seeing to its needs and the needs of the people it represents, and we know that that was a qualification. It's taking care of its business. It has nothing to do with you. And your silly notion, or I should say our silly notion, because I'm putting myself there, our silly notion that we as citizens have some degree of authority over what a government does and what a government is, that we have control over the throttle and the brake of government. That is a figment of somebody's imagination. This entire election process is going to be decided within the parties who have their own rules that countermand and contravene the whole idea of one person, one vote. They make up their rules. And we have to live with the end result of it. We may not have participated in it, but that doesn't mean that we have any power over it. We don't. We will be crazy to think that we have some significant power. The power equation has remained exactly the same from beginning to now. There's been no change. From time, like I said, you know, there's a little realignment, but the power equation remains exactly the same. There's no change there. Well, look at all these black and brown people who have been elected, they would say, to all these different offices at every level. And I say, okay. And how do we explain that with the infusion of melanated blood, you still have very little, if any change, significant change at all, in the objective conditions of life? How do you explain that? Precisely at a time, let's say in New York City, precisely at a time that its city council, the governing authority of the entire city, has a record number of African American and Latino representatives, it is more powerless than ever. How do you explain that? And you have a city in which people are being killed all the time by police, and schools are shut down, and you have substandard city services, and you have a foreclosure rate that will make your head spin, going all the way back to the 60s. You had an entire village the size of many small islands literally burned out to get rid of people. You don't believe me? Ask anybody about the South Bronx and how Harlem had been depopulated. So there's no correlation between numbers and power. The power equation remains exactly the same. So if you understand systems and how they work, you see how logical it is. You could sit here and literally predict several decades from now what is likely to happen, because the system remains remarkably consistent, because it sees to it that its existence remains unchanged as much as possible. It does not change to suit people because it's scientifically devised to resist change. It is the people who change to suit it. Which is why I keep asking the question, who is forcing Bernie Sanders, the so-called alter choice, the other choice from Hillary Clinton within the Democratic Party, what is he going to do with these millions of votes that he'll get in this election? Why would he think that he is entitled, just like Jesse Jackson, we talked about that, that he singularly is entitled to do whatever it is he wants to do with this movement? Who is calling him to account? The effort seems to be, let's get Bernie elected. I say, okay, that's a viable thing. Go ahead. If anybody but Hillary Clinton. But in as much as he is getting this kind of response, he has to answer some questions, and now. He has to do it now. He has to be forced to make it plain now. Or else he too should be moved against. Hardball. As they say, it's not personal, it's just business. If Bernie Sanders is going to do a Jesse Jackson and take all of these votes and hand them to Hillary Clinton and to the Democratic Party, I say we ought to know that now and call off all bets now. He has to be made to state affirmatively a commitment to do something with these votes. He has the votes. He's getting the votes. And whether he wins the nomination or he doesn't win the nomination within the Democratic Party does not, in my view, cancel out his obligation or the people's obligation to insist that out of this, you take your votes and you go with them. You build your own thing. This is not a gift to the Democratic Party. The votes, whatever votes there are of Bernie Sanders, it seems to me, Bernie Sanders needs to be called on the carpet now. In fact, it might even be late in the game. But he has to be publicly stating what he intends to do with these votes. Where are they going to go? My contention is that he's winning. And I tell you, I define it winning very differently. He has gained significant ground on the strength of an investment of a broad coalition of people who see the need to move away from the standard issue Democratic Party into something else. Can't tolerate Hillary Clinton at all on any level. That's a real wipeout right there. But we have to talk to Bernie. A conversation needs to be had. What are you going to do, Mr. Sanders, with all of these votes that you're getting? That people are making a conscious decision to differentiate you from a Hillary Clinton and the rest of the Republican rabble, and they're investing in you. Come the Democratic Convention in July, what are you going to do? Are you going to become the acolyte of Hillary Clinton and the Democrats? Are you going to find a rationale to turn all these votes over to them? And we are suddenly to believe that having capitulated to the system, you somehow are able to make it bend to your will? Are you crazy? We got to know. And at the same time, outside of Bernie Sanders, there ought to be independent action. Wherever these votes are coming from, there ought to be some kind of a beginning of an alternative political party. Build a party on the strength of this activity happening now that can sustain candidacies at all levels independently of the Democratic Party. It should be its own party. That's what you do. The Democratic Party has not been very kind to the masses of people in this country, and particularly unkind to the oppressed classes in this country. And that's a historical fact. The misery that people have been suffering from all these decades, principally, there's been no distinction between the way Democratic and Republican administrations have responded. They are of the same mind because they are of the same ilk. But this time, because this is a historical moment, we should move in a new way, create new possibilities, and be aggressive. My telltale phrase was that we have to be just absolutely aggressive about our interests. I think this is the opportune moment. And we can confront the system of white supremacy if we have a galvanization of interests. But we have to move now, and we have to call Bernie Sanders to account. He has to be made to state emphatically what he intends to do with all these votes. We cannot afford to have another Jesse Jackson moment. We went through it in 84. We went through it in 88. We went through a Barack Obama. We can't have a Bernie Sanders moment that duplicates the same pattern. Not now. So those are my thoughts. And as you look at this unfolding election, look at it as history unfolding before your eyes, and specifically within the context of what we know to be the standing order. This is an apartheid society. It has its own apartheid rules. In fact, the United States taught South Africa and other the crazy places of the world a thing or two about race oppression. Born right here. So when they tell you about, oh my God, all this violence, well, you know, that's the history of the U.S. Born in the crucible of violence. Violence is not at all foreign to the United States. Every day people are subjected to all kinds of violence, administrative violence, political violence, economic violence. So don't get all rattled by all of these things. Understand them differently. Understand them in the context of things. Because the science of it, you know, we think racism is just the spontaneous expression of bad manners. No, it's not. It's a science. And it's a science because it produces exactly the same result when applied under prevailing conditions. That makes it a science. So if you're going to tackle this thing, this scientific thing, unscientifically, you know, you're climbing Mount Everest backwards, okay? I thank you for joining me today. I hope somehow in all of that was said, you find something to latch on to. And even criticize, but certainly examine for further discussion as we go along. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Infectious Myth with David Crow. I really do like the title of that show, and I like the content of that program. You should stay tuned and give it a listen. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Let me know what you're thinking about the program. And as always, it's a pleasure, and for me, a great privilege to be in your company. I don't take it for granted. Thanks for listening. We'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.